Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we're talking politics, including Scott Brown's possible, yes, presidential ambitions. Then, yet another case of horrific violence against a young woman, this time by a famous Red Sox broadcaster's son, who was freed from jail before the killing despite, again, a long history of violence. The Reverend Eugene Rivers III joins us. We'll talk what gay white men and black men have in common. Then, moms and dads out there with young kids, can you afford to go out anymore when babysitters are costing you up to $20 an hour? And finally, with Whitey Bulger off to prison, we're going to talk to Garen Daly about fantastic prison break movies. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Marjorie Egan, this is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, outrageously, is still on vacation. But Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and South End News, is here to ably fill in for the still vacationing Jim Browdy. Thanks, Sue, for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. And, you know, getting Jim rested and nice. You know, what an idea. He's going to come back a people
That's
lover.
Right. He needs more rest.
A people person.
Other people. So we're going to start today with a little bit of politics. Hillary Clinton, of course, she's teasing America, will she run or won't she? Charlie Baker, the former gubernatorial candidate, the Republican, is teasing Massachusetts, will he run for governor or won't he? Now, incredibly, Scott Brown is joining the will he or won't he game. After a weekend touring the Iowa State Fair, we are asking, is Scott Brown now considering the biggest prize of all, the White House? Here with us to go over all this and political news of the week are Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies. Thank you, Charlie, for coming in today.
Well, thank you, Marjorie.
And Aaron O'Brien, a professor of political science at UMass Boston. Thank you, too, Aaron, for coming in.
Lovely to be here.
So are we supposed to take this seriously with Scott Brown out at the Iowa State Fair saying he's testing the waters, Charlie Chipio?
Yeah, I mean, at least he came out and said it. Which was nice for a change. The thing that amazed me was reading in the Herald today about talking about his wife Gail's Iowa roots. This is amazing. Everybody, all these candidates right. have roots everywhere. It's remarkable to me.
Yeah, I didn't know she had Iowa. We had on the
Maybe
front
she
page.
Didn't know. Right. She didn't know.
Oddly, that didn't come up prior.
I just don't get it.
I think it's a total joke.
You do?
Why do you
Complete
think it's a joke?
And total joke. I think he misses being in the limelight. He knows he's going to get some attention. He wants to be a rock star. He does not want to be a president.
But isn't that true of just about every candidate for every office?
Yes, but I don't think he enjoys the substance as much. It's mm-hmm. He's not running for governor because governor is a tougher job. Being a senator, you got a lot of agenda space, but you don't have to do nearly as much, mm-hmm. and you don't have to make the tough decisions.
Charlie, do you think that this? It's funny. Folks will come to me and say, "What do you think about Scott Brown as president? What kind of candidate do you think he would be?" And although I'm not in love with him for governor, I do think as a Republican who represents a more moderate and centrist view of things, I think that he would be a great candidate, if not serious, just in order to shape the Republican dogma a little bit.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting test this time around for the Republicans. You know, they have really gone over the edge. I mean, they're insane. And it's going to be very interesting with people like Christie and Brown, who are a lot more reasonable, to see if these folks actually get some traction. And if so, you know, obviously they would be going after the same voters. Mm-hmm. As Aaron said, it's yet to be seen whether this is real. I don't know.
Well, you mentioned Chris Christie. Of course, he was in Boston last week. He was not invited to a previous Republican get-together, that CPAC thing they do every year. Wasn't even invited to come. But Chris Christie came to Boston last week at the summer meeting of the Republicans at the down the waterfront at the Westin down there. He got a standing ovation. So these are the grassroots people that were there. So what do we make of that?
They're
Aaron?
Not the grassroots people.
They're not.
They're the grassroots.
They were lying to me. They told me they were.
Well, everyone loves that title, but whether they are, I think they were grassroots, more New Englanders, and people who are willing in an off-cycle year to come to Boston. So as Charlie was saying, of course he gets a nice round there, but it speaks to the split between the Republican Party. He gets a round from people who are not in key primary states and therefore can't affect the primary, ergo who the actual candidate is.
But Chris Christie also didn't speak to anybody. You know, it's sort of he's afraid, or the Republican Party's afraid of his saying things that might go on record to show the Republican Party actually cares about people.
This amazes me that, you know, you have Christie does that. I think to a degree, Brown doesn't really want to. His interactions with the media are very scripted. You know, I saw an article lately about how Elizabeth Warren doesn't talk to the media. Right. I mean, why not? What are they afraid
of? Well, let's hear Scott Brown. He was at the Iowa State Fair, and that is, of course, a traditional place where people begin to show up, because Iowa is the first primary, at least it always has been.
It's the caucus,
the first caucus before the New Hampshire primary. And that's, you know, catapulted Barack Obama into fame and fortune. So here's Scott Brown with his wife, Gail Huff, explaining why they both showed up.
It's really not about me. It's about bringing a message, I think, to America, which is, listen, there's a tremendous amount of division. There's divisions on the left and the right with the extremes. And in the middle, there's a very small group of people.
Okay, Scott Brown is in that very small group.
Yes, and
the
kings and queens will be calling him in the event of, you know, there's a national emergency, and he'll just pick up the speak to the new Prince George.
You know, but he's not incorrect there.
He is right.
And it is actually, I think you misspoke, it's a big group of people in that middle. But the challenge is that's not who elects
candidate. It's not a big group of elected officials.
Exactly.
It's a big group of people. But that also makes me think I should run for office. Because you know what? Because as the youngest son, an Italian family, I would absolutely go in there and say, it's all about me. It's always been about me. You know, I wouldn't lie about it.
We're talking with Charlie Chipio from Chipio Strategies and Aaron O'Brien from UMass. Let me ask you guys, so the Republicans do have a big dilemma, because I was thinking that this last week with Chris Christie. Now, Chris Christie used to be pro-choice, now he's pro-life. Chris Christie just passed some tougher gun regulations in New Jersey, not hugely tough. The NRA wasn't thrilled, but gun rights people weren't thrilled either.
He just signed this legislation that stopped the program to try to talk gay teenagers into them.
That's really a very forward thinking.
He's not pro gay marriage, but he's much more he's pro gay civil union. Is that correct, Sue O'Connell?
Yeah, I mean, New Jersey's
a blue state.
Yeah, I think he's one of those people, though, that if you hung him upside down and shook him, he would come up a liberal. I mean, I really don't believe
on that.
On social policy.
No, I think on a lot of issues. I mean, I just really think
he wants immigration reform. Yep. And so my question is, I guess, how does a Christie, and Brown is even more to the left on social issues. He's a pro-choice guy. We've fought about this a million times in Massachusetts. How pro-choice is he? But so say you get a Christie. I don't think it's going to happen. I think I'm with you, Aaron. I think this is about, you know, it makes him more valuable to his law firm, too, when he's on the front page of the paper all the time as a rainmaker.
Indeed.
But anyway, if it were to happen that Christie and Brown are there in the primary stage, and they are so far to the left on a lot of these social conservatives in the Republican Party, it's a joke for them, isn't it? I mean, these initial primary.
Well, to shape the discussion. I mean, you know, everybody, the idea of running for a lot of candidates is they all say they want to win, but it's also to shape the discussion and to change America. I think the idea of even a Brown Christie ticket is a very exciting idea for many practical progressives.
Well, I think that's right. But I also think that the idea of the two of them, fighting each other and clearing the way for a Rand Paul nomination is pretty terrifying.
And the thing is, Republicans aren't talking about that ticket. Mm-hmm. We're talking about here today in the East, in New England, it's potentially exciting, but it's not getting traction anywhere else. And ask a John Huntsman how he changed the conversation. Mm-hmm. He's been ridiculed.
Much more liberal. John Huntsman.
I don't know who that is.
You're
kidding.
Very middle.
Touché.
I'm excited about him, by the way.
A lot of people were, but not people who are controlling the money.
Yeah. But again, you say to yourself, then if the Republicans do nominate Rand Paul, how does Rand Paul get anywhere in the general election?
He doesn't.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of there was an interesting piece in the New York Times over the weekend talking about Jeb Bush, of course, the younger brother of George Bush. Jeb is about 60 years old. He was quite popular when he was the governor of Florida, been out of office for a while now. But he's, again, talking path to citizenship on immigration, big on school choice. He's sort of an attractive guy, although he's, again, more middle of the road. Aaron O'Brien.
I can't. I just can't. I can't have another Bush.
Yeah.
I'm kidding around a little bit, but I am more serious in the sense that there is the only people that really want Jeb Bush are the Bushies who have been out for a while. It's not that he doesn't have some good centrist policy. It's not that he doesn't have some policy that would really appeal to mass publics. But that last name, we're tired of it.
You know, I think that he's kind of like the George Bailey of the Bush family. You know, he had to stay at home while his brother got to go to war. He had to, you know, and finally, at the end of the movie, Jeb Bush is going to be George Bailey surrounded by his friends and become president of the United States.
Well, the difference is that George Bailey's brother was smart. And you know, Jeb is a lot smarter than George was.
Yeah, so. And George didn't go to war. Well, he's not one of the
problems. He got to have all the bells and whistles. I mean, I think,
well, he did when he announced that the mission was accomplished.
Oh, okay. That's right.
He was all dressed up for that.
I thought you meant
he went to the movies.
Yeah. He was flying around somewhere there in Texas with the National Guard. Wasn't that what he was doing when he was
supposed to? Although we're not sure.
We're
not really sure because there was no attendance taken, apparently.
Okay, can we move on to Hillary Clinton? Now, once again, I mean, she's doing all the right things. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Erin O'Brien?
She's running. 0% doubt in my mind. 100% she's running. She's built her resume since when Jeb Bush left, right? She's been senator. She's been secretary of state. She's at all the right meetings. She's lining up all the right endorsements. She is running. 100%.
Yeah, I agree with that. When she stepped down as Secretary of State, I would have said she looks very tired. I don't know if she has the stomach for it. You know, I'm not sure. But in what's happened recently, I would agree. I'm absolutely certain she's running. And I would also say, you know, it's interesting. I think Marjorie, you and I are alike on this one. If you had talked to me 2 or 3 years ago, I was appalled by her and her time as Secretary of State. It really changed that. I have a great deal more respect for her.
And Erin, what does this say? You know, I think she's running too, but what does this say about the Democratic field? You know, what does this say about Joe Biden? What does this say about others that haven't stepped forward yet? Are we going to be in a case where she's sort of just...
You know, the fact that we're talking about Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton shows it's not a meritocracy right. to get to the top. She can clear the field. And I think even more so than when she ran against Obama, the 8 years since I teach women in politics, I do a lot of work in that area. I sense even more of a hunger for a female president than I did 8 years ago.
And I'm someone who's more bros before.
No. I've been skeptical of that argument because I think a lot of times when she ran against Obama, it was a lot of, you know, more elite white women who wanted her to win. But I've seen that trickle down a lot more. So I think that the power of her candidacy is more unified and a lot of younger women as well who weren't as excited. They used to see her as just another institutionalist. She was no change. And I think she's rebranded quite well.
I think you are going to see a couple of sort of rising stars, different people like the Martin O'Malley's of the world, the governor of Maryland. I think there's going to be a couple of those candidates too, though. I don't think it's just going to be the Bidens and the Clintons.
I think they're running for practice, though.
Well, that may be true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're talking with Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies and Erin O'Brien, a professor of political science at UMass Boston. Charlie Chipio, I want to get back to one of the things you said about Hillary Clinton, though. To me, when she ran the first time against Obama, she was Bill Clinton's wife. And I sort of resented a little bit when she was in the White House that she was riding on his coattails. Mm-hmm. Someone of her accomplishments, obviously a brilliant lawyer. You know, she gets going to run the health care thing, which totally fell apart and so forth. But then she did... As you say, or I've said, or many people have said, stepped
all the
out.
Great minds have
all the great minds, exactly.
The modest great minds.
Yeah, I mean, she stepped out on her own and did a great job as governor of New York. And Benghazi was obviously a low moment in her tenure as Secretary of State. But she's not his just appendage anymore. You know, yeah. I mean, and that's what she was to me the first time around.
Yeah, and I also felt that a couple of things. One, she didn't always seem like she was a Stepford wife, and she didn't always seem scripted, like she always had seemed when she was running. And that really made a difference to me. And I also was impressed at the way that she actually seemed to put the country first. And, you know, instead of holding a grudge against Obama for beating her, you know, she worked for him. She did a good job. She did the right thing. And, you know, I respect it.
And Americans, I think, really respond to people working hard, you know, and no matter who it is and what job it is. And she worked very hard. The amount of hours and miles that she logged out of the United States in different countries. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that, you know, regardless of your appraisal of her, what kind of job she did, she worked hard at that job, and that got her lots of cred.
And I think it's important to remember what a purposeful frame it was, what an attack there really was on her to negate her. When she was in office, quote unquote, with Bill Clinton, but when she was the first lady, there was an attack machine. And they sort of lost a little bit of interest once she became senator and once she became Secretary of State, which I think allowed her to shine in ways she probably already was, but made it harder for us to see because of the attacks on her.
But what kind of liability, let's, you know, pretend she is running and is Bill Clinton? I mean, you know, I've heard a number of times that her hesitancy in becoming Secretary of State was around Bill Clinton, and that, you know, his I talked to many women who were supporting Hillary until they felt, you know, some of the things that Bill said about Obama during the campaign, especially around the Carolina primary.
South Carolina primary,
was damaged her credibility, and they voted for Obama.
You know, I don't think it's an issue. I think Bill gives a great speech. We saw him at the DNC. He wants her to win, and he wants her to win bad this time.
I wonder, though, you know, I just recently read this, and I certainly can't claim to have followed it. I wonder if the new problem that she might have with him is some of the financing of his foundation.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I wonder if that's going to be the coming problem.
Well, but they thought that was going to be a problem with her as Secretary of State. I mean, that came up already when she went, and for some reason it just got mellowed out, that's not the kind of
story that's going to move people that are or are not positively inclined towards her. I think the people who already dislike her will, feed on that. But I don't think it's going to, you know, technical terms, hurt the mushy middle. Yeah. You know, I don't think that's the kind of story that has legs for them.
We're talking with Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies and Erin O'Brien from UMass on the political developments over the weekend, the last few days. You know, this has been developing forever. Every week Charlie Brekke comes in here. He's coming in here tomorrow. We say, okay, you're running. Now he's decided he's going to make up his mind whether he's going to run for governor on Labor Day. Is he running?
He hasn't talked to me. I sure hope he is. I think that he would be the best governor, in my view, of the folks who are I'm seeing out there. You know, the question is, you know, can he be a better campaigner than he was last time? And I think related to that is, you know, is there the talent out there in terms of campaign operatives in Massachusetts? You know, really good Republican campaign people
Chipio.
Are running Republican.
I'll write about it.
I mean,
you know, Erin, I felt that Baker made sort of the same kind of run that Brown did. Like, neither of them talked to Bay Windows, our gay paper, because I'm sure they didn't want to be on record saying positive things, like the things they really really think. And at the same time, you know, they totally missed a big part of the electorate, which were independents, that with they're not talking to minority magazines or newspapers in general. You can't run like that and win in Massachusetts.
But I think what they're doing, especially in Boston, and this is a hypothesis, but I think they're spending a lot more time in Western Mass, shoring up Western Mass, because that's a part of the state that tends to get ignored. It's more Republican than here. And right now, Boston's so enveloped in a mayor's race that I think they're thinking, okay, we need to make up those votes. Who's more positively inclined? We'll go to Western Mass and ignore, unfortunately for me, I think, the gay papers, the communities of color, because we have a better shot in mobilizing just straight up votes from Western Mass.
Who's out there mobilizing?
What do you mean?
Is Charlie Baker's people out there mobilizing?
My understanding,
Republicans just in general?
Republican strategists
in general.
And Republican candidates. I don't know. I said it's a hypothesis because I don't know if Baker himself is doing that.
Okay.
But that is a tried and true way.
I think they really need to talk to the gay media and ethnic media and things like that. Because, look, you know, the reality is that the pull and the political force of the unions for any Democrat is so immense that you've got to come up with any way you possibly can in Massachusetts to try to counterbalance that.
And who's on the tier for the Democrats? Who are we looking at maybe? Has anybody stepped forward yet, or are we all still focusing on the city race that all the Democrats? No, nothing? Nobody?
Well, we have the gentleman from Cape Air that we had on the news last week.
Yeah, Dan Wolf.
Been told by the Ethics Commission, I don't get this, frankly.
It's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy.
Not only can he not run for governor unless he divests himself
as Cape Air, but
he has to step down from being a state senator as well. Now, I think this is an overreach by the Ethics Commission.
I agree 100%. I can't help but compare it to, and this is just the example that comes to my head. I don't mean a Republican Democrat, but think of a Dick Cheney with Halliburton.
I know.
Or any of this. Like, when did we, I wish we cared this much about corporate overlay in politics, but it seems to me this guy is being unfairly singled out when these kind of connections happen all the time.
Well, there's two points to this, too. I mean, regardless of Democrat or Republican, Dan Wolf is exactly the type of person that you want to run for office. He's exactly the type of public servant that you want. And, you know, there's all the rumblings in the Twitter world about which political operative kind of put this forward and how it's going to blow back on that political operative's
team
and candidate. I mean, it's sort of like if this is the most dirt that they can stir up, they're going to find a way to do it.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think it's also interesting to sort of watch this reincarnation of Martha Coakley, you know, and then, you know, she's now clearly interested in running for governor, which didn't seem to be the case just a year or two ago. So that's going to be an interesting
one to watch.
I think she's going to run.
I hope not. Because that would be a dilemma. Because I like them both. I like Charlie Baker and I like Martha.
It's hard.
And they need to mobilize you.
And it would be a dilemma, you know, for me anyway. But who cares about my personal dilemmas? Okay, let's move on to the mayoral race. It is beginning to pick up a little steam. I mean, the conventional wisdom is nobody's going to pay attention until after Labor Day, and the primary is the 24th, and two people out of the 12 will survive. But it's getting more and more exciting. Do you think there's a favorite here, Erin O'Brien?
Well, I have to be truthful here. I am doing policy work for Marty Walsh.
Okay.
So guess who I think?
Right. Well, Erin, let me ask
but
you.
I do think that's a fair surmise that he is definitely the top two.
Erin, let me ask you. We had a conversation last year or the year before about voter turnout and how it's affected by negative ad campaigns. How we all say, oh, it works, but we're not really examining how it's suppressing people who just tune it off. We have had an incredibly civil mayoral race so far, where not only are they not criticizing Menino, they're not criticizing each other. When you try and get them at a debate to engage with each other, they fall over each other to say what good ideas. How do you think this thoughtful campaign with not a lot of negative attacks is going to affect voter turnout in Boston?
I think it'll change post-Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason people aren't paying attention, because it's this hodgepodge, again, technical terms, hodgepodge, blodge, whatever, of 12 candidates that are difficult to distinguish. Now, their ground games are so different. That's where they greatly distinguish themselves. But right now, there's no political incentive to come out against Menino. Now, we were talking, Charlie and I were talking in the green room, that Walczak has come out and said no to casinos.
Mm-hmm. And he's the only one, correct, that is against casinos. I mean, I think that is a big deal, Charlie.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I got to tell you, I love him for it because, casinos to me are the equivalent of just waving the white flag, saying we can't balance the budget. We don't know how to do this. And we're just going to sell our soul. Especially on top of it, you have the fact that every place in America is opening casinos, so you have sort of a finite resource there. Yeah. I think we are going to get a lot of trouble from casinos socially, very little money. I think it's a nightmare, and I really give Walczak credit for coming out and saying that. The other thing I would say, given my bias that I'm excited about who I see as the top candidates, is that, you know, whether it's Walsh or it's Connolly or several of these other top tier candidates, they are all in favor of lifting the cap on charter schools, which would be a real change from what we have right now. And I think very exciting.
You know, I was at a number of graduate, not graduation, but going off to college events over the past week. And a lot of the older folks from Massachusetts and the Boston area said, and not in a critical way, but they never thought they would see a day where a white man would have a chance of being mayor again because of the changing dynamics in the city. Just as a sort of statistical report, but it's very likely that we're going to have a white guy as mayor again.
And, you know, I'd like to add on to that I was talking, this was Andrew Ryan from The Globe. I was talking to him, and he presented some information. If you look at their fundraising, the top six fundraisers are the white men, and all the candidates of color are 7 through 12.
But that says to me,
as a political scientist who studies this, I look at what's going on in New York. Their quote unquote race is much more advanced if you will. We've had a 20-year pause button in Boston.
Right.
What do you mean advanced? You mean with women or
just outreach strategies, the level of the number of consultants per capita, just the outreach. We don't have good data to predict who will turn out.
Right. We're trying to use bingo. Yeah.
Right. We're trying to use special election data or presidential election data.
Because they've had Menino and there's been no
20
real
years.
Race.
Okay.
So it's sort of like the Wild Wild East, which doesn't really work, but this is an unknown in a lot of ways. And with that pause button, I don't think it's an accident that the top candidates are white men because of the institutional bias. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be malicious.
No, it's just it's
big
status
donors,
quo, sort
right,
of.
Yeah. Big donors think of who's the mayor of Boston, and they're thinking of the most viable candidates as white guys. And unfortunately, wealth and income inequality in the United States and in Boston, communities of color are a lot worse off. So if you're drawing from that population primarily to get money, you've got less of a pool just when you start.
Charlie, I've been saying that, part of this mix of candidates is that Menino never really developed a strong tier or number two or number three or a team of folks on the bench who could come forward. I mean, because of his management style and his the way. And so, the good news is we have a wide open field. The bad news is we have a wide open field.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's certainly interesting to watch. It's like 1983 for those of us who are old enough to remember that. But it's true. And I think Aaron is right. I mean, that's the key point of this whole thing to me. Every poll we see is based on, assumptions about who's going to turn out. And it's been so long since we've had an open race. We don't know who's going to turn out. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really the wild card here.
Well, there was a great little statistical thing that the Globe did a couple of days ago talking about if 10 of the 12 each get 8.2%.
Oh, yeah. Tom Keene's thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Tom Keene. I'm sorry.
Such a Tom Keene thing.
Too. Yeah, right.
They could lose.
I love it.
They could lose to the person who gets 9%.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that shows how close it is and how getting out the vote is so crucial. Now, John Conley has been in first place in the poll that the Herald did a while ago, but he has only 12% of the vote. So, and Charlotte Goler-Richie is in sixth place, with 5%. So he's in first place with 12%. She's in sixth place with 5%. I mean, this is really a down-to-the-wire kind of race.
It's all about the ground game. That's why you haven't seen that much political advertising. You know, the vast majority of the candidates have not gone to the television airwaves because they know that the way they're going to win is getting people to the polls, both for the primary and the general.
You should win with Marty Walsh because you get all the union people, right?
And a lot of others. But yes, his ground game is the best in the game.
You know, and you've got everybody was sort of the insiders were criticizing Dan Connolly for the Boston Strangler case because he found a case that little old ladies cared about. You know, the only people that really can remember. You know, I was a child when.
I remember it very well. I'm in a little old lady condition.
And, you know those buses are going to show up at the elderly homes and drive them to the polls. And it's a really good old-fashioned gumshoe get-out-the-vote policy.
It is. But, you also see some changes, some sort of forward-looking stuff. I mean, the way John Connolly has been doing all his messages and his website in different languages and things like that. You know, you are seeing some positive changes, I think. Some people who are not running the last campaign.
The candidates are going to, the question that Sue had earlier, the candidates are going to communities of color. Mm-hmm. They're going to LGBTQ audiences. Our candidates are not limiting themselves to only an identity politics race. That's why I think, so there has been real change.
Yeah, and the negative, I mean, I was telling Marjorie before we went on, the negative conversation when I've interviewed each of them, except for Yancey so far, at Bay Windows for a voter's guide, is that they're finding little tiny negative things to say each other about gay stuff. Like, in 1993, he only supported civil unions. And I'm like, well, that's all there was. And then like, well, your candidate was in high school in 1993. Right. Well, he would have supported same-sex marriage. And I'm like, this is really the conversation. I mean, they're fighting
in the
for
student
each
council in election.
Right.
We're talking with Charlie Chippia from Chippia Strategies and Aaron O'Brien from UMass Boston and, of course, Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows is filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Here's a scenario that lots of people are talking about Aaron O'Brien. Say it is Marty Walsh that makes it to the final, or it's John Conley that makes it to the final, or it's the district attorney Dan Conley that makes it to the final, and Charlotte Goler-Richie makes it to the final. Mm-hmm. Then you have the white Irish guy versus the possibly first black or first woman, first African-American, first woman, the historic kind of moment here. What happens
Well, we're not talking about the Menino machine. You know, the Menino machine and where the Menino machine is going to go to help get someone elected. And the rumor is that it's Charlotte Golar Richie, even though he has not come out for or against anyone. I mean, that...
I thought it was Rob Consalvo from Hyde Park.
I'm not up on this, though.
I had heard Charlotte as well. But he's going sort of dancing between the two.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that you know, also comes to what happens, who's out there, it's not just about the unions and the bodies, but it's also about the
and the
money
that comes in. If it's Conley and Walsh, it'll be a lot of charter school money, as Charlie pointed out. It'll be a lot of that money that comes in. If it's Charlotte, Emily Sliss has endorsed, but they haven't given a ton of money.
Right.
You know, it's an off-year election cycle. But if it looks like she might actually, if she's in the final two, a lot more money will come in from communities of color.
But, you know, I'm a little suspicious about the Menino Charlotte Golar Richie theory, even though she did work for him, because shouldn't she have more money if she had Menino people quietly working behind the scenes?
I think he's been talking, but I really don't think he has been getting his people to write checks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, her campaign just doesn't. It's early. There's going to be going to change a million times, but it doesn't seem to be moving as of yet.
She's an interesting story, and a lot of us want her to be the story, but she hasn't become the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
she's very tall. I've noticed that.
She is tall, and she doesn't say a lot of specifics, which is smart.
A candidate who doesn't say a lot of specifics.
But she's really good at it. She's really good at not doing it. That's what I mean. Well, we're talking politics, and I'm sure this is a conversation that will continue. So thanks so much for Charlie Scipio from Scipio Strategies and Erin O'Brien, a political science professor at UMass. Thanks so much for joining us. When we come back, we're going to look at how the murder of Jennifer Martel could have been prevented. She was stabbed to death last week, allegedly by Jarrett Remy. Wendy Murphy joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
So far this year, there have been over 30 homicides in the city of Boston.
Shootings may be down, and homicides may be down, but violence is not down.
Whether it's one person or 100 people, it's bad. People are dying.
I'm reporter James Edwards with a series on rising from violence in Boston, tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Russell's, a family gardening tradition for over 135 years with annuals, perennials, herbs and shrubs, bird baths, statuary, pots, plus jewelry, gifts, and toys. Russell's Garden Center, Route 20, Wayland. And Leap, a full-service branding agency for organizations in applied sciences, life sciences, higher education, and financial services. Leap, the branding agency for innovators. More online at leapwith.us.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady is on vacation. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and South End News is filling in for Jim. Okay, for the second time in just a few weeks, we are faced with yet another case of a violent attack on a young woman. Earlier this month, it was 24-year-old Amy Lord of South Boston. She was stabbed to death by a criminal with a violent history. Now, 27-year-old Jennifer Martel was stabbed to death in Waltham, allegedly by the father of their 4-year-old child. That would be Jarrett Remy, some of the famous Red Sox player and now broadcaster Jerry Remy. This time, not even 2 days before the killing, the alleged killer was booked and released despite his violent past and despite charges that he slammed his girlfriend's head into a mirror. And authorities never even asked for a dangerousness hearing. With us to talk about this, and we're going to take your calls on this as well a little bit later, is Wendy Murphy, a legal expert and former prosecutor. And her latest book is, and it's a terrific book, And Justice for Some. Wendy, thanks for being here.
Oh, good to be with you both.
You know, the thing that has upset me most about this story, Wendy, is that repeatedly we heard authorities tell the Herald, tell the Globe, that their conversations with the victim here, Jennifer Martel, and her not wanting the restraining order renewed and her being hesitant about prosecution is the reason they let this guy go. And it just drove me crazy. It's almost like blaming the victim.
Almost like?
Yeah.
I mean, it is the quintessential blame the victim tactic that I actually write about in my book. This, you know, is a whole chapter. This idea that for women in violent homes and in violent relationships, we say on the one hand, oh, well, we want to respect her right to live in violence, so we're going to dismiss the restraining order at her request or dismiss the charges. And then when she dies, it's especially convenient for prosecutors who say, well, you know, we tried to save her life, but she begged us to let her live in a violent home, and it's her fault she's dead. That is so common. But And I don't know how many times we've talked about that over the years. But
a lot.
Exactly. So, you know, no one's learning any lessons. And yet, in this case, I wouldn't even put this case in that same category because this is not a woman who was saying, please let him come home.
Right.
You know, this is a woman who was saying, I can't wait to get away. I'm terrified. I'm afraid for my life. Please help me. And the only reason she didn't continue with her emergency restraining order, according to all reports, and I don't care how much backpedaling there is that she was pressured by Jared Remy's family, and in particular, she's named the mom, to more than one person. She said, the mother called me and pressured me. And one report says that the mother said, please drop the restraining order or it will ruin his life. And I just want to call that mother up and say, how do you like what happened to her life?
Wendy, talk a little bit about, I'm a little foggy on this dangerousness hearing, and when does it happen, when doesn't it happen, what is it exactly, and how do you get one?
Well, there's a lot of stuff in that question,
yeah,
including that it's an option, it's not a mandate, which is a problem, because it has to be requested. Now, the judge can do it on his or her own as well, so we can't only blame the prosecutor and the cops for not calling it to the judge's attention. The judge could have said it on his own. I think there should be a dangerousness hearing, and everybody wants to point the finger at the other. They're all to blame. Every one of them should be partly blamed for murder, in my opinion. But when you request one, the good news is, and this is why it's such a nice procedural device, it allows for a long cooling off period, and this guy could have used a 5-year cooling off period, if you know what I mean. And he got nothing. The police didn't hold him. They should have. The dangerousness hearing would have held him. It didn't, because nobody mentioned it. And more importantly, the woman could have gotten a no-contact order from the judge as a matter of bail upon request by the prosecutor or on the judge's own volition. Even if she said, I don't want a restraining order, that's the whole point. The criminal justice system is not the victim's personal lawsuit. She doesn't get to dictate what law enforcement and judicial officials do to protect the public, including her.
I was with some retired law enforcement folks over the past over the weekend, and many of them said also in the case of the alleged perpetrator of the murder last week, who left his wallet allegedly in the hand of the unconscious woman in Mission Hill after he had mugged her, that it's. They feel like their hands are tied when they can't get someone to come forward. And like the woman who had the wallet, she didn't want to go forward and testify. Let's just say that that's how they feel, and it is what it is. And let's just say, you know, victims for one reason or another are hesitant to testify or come forward. What can we do? What can we change that allows us to go forward with restraining orders without victims asking for it, and for police and law enforcement to have a better tool that they can use to protect people?
Yeah, and they already have the tools.
What is that?
They're just not using them.
Okay.
So the one is, for a victim to drop her own restraining order, even if it's a bad idea, she can do that. But in connection with formal criminal charges, the prosecutor can and should, especially with a record like this, ask for a no-contact order from the court. The victim cannot drop a court-ordered no-contact order, and it has the same effect as a restraining order, in that the guy goes to jail if he goes anywhere near her or uses mummy to call her up. That did not happen, and it could have happened. When law enforcement says we can't proceed without the victim, that's a lie. You don't say to the key eyewitness to a bank robbery or a home invasion, oh, do you feel like testifying? And if you don't, we'll just drop the charges.
But what Wendy, by the way, I should reintroduce you here, Wendy. Wendy Murphy is a legal expert, former prosecutor. Her latest book is Injustice for Some. You and I have talked about this for years.
Yep.
There is a dispute, as I understand it, and you know better than I do, in the domestic violence community, where some advocates want the power, and it is power, unfortunately, in the victim's hands to say, oh, no, let's not prosecute. Some other people like you, and I happen to think you're correct, say take it out of her hands, because it if you are beaten badly, as this woman allegedly was on Tuesday night, and you're pressured allegedly by the family not to proceed, obviously you're thinking to yourself, or you could be thinking to yourself, I'm not going to press for any more charges against this guy because he'll come back and beat me more viciously. So
right.
Other places, I think, are take this out of her hands completely.
Yep.
And say, it's not up to you. We're prosecuting whether you want us to prosecute or not.
Right.
But there's a divide in the domestic violence community about this, isn't there?
Well, yes, there's a bit of a divide, but it's not a legitimate divide. And I have to be firm about this, because the data shows us that in the jurisdictions that adopt what are called no-drop policies.
Like where?
Like San Diego County, there's a section within San Diego County in California where they did a study for 5 years, and there was the same kind of quote-unquote divide in the DV community there as well, but women were dying at a rate of, let's say, I forget the exact number, but it was around 40 people, 40 women died in a given year. Over the next 5 years, they did mandatory no-drops. No one could ever drop the charges. 5 years later, the number of domestic violence homicides was in the single digits, and the only policy change was that they adopted no-drop policies in every prosecutor's office. Everybody in Massachusetts knows that data. Jane Doe, shame on them, because they have tremendous power and leadership in Massachusetts. They do not support the idea of no-drop policies, and they say what you just suggested. Well, we want to give the victim the power to decide. You know, it's not the victim. Calling it power doesn't make it power. You give her the choice, and you're really giving him the choice to control not just her, but the criminal justice system.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. What about the idea that by making it a no-drop system, women would be less likely, some women, to come forward because they know that they would have to go forward with this, and it would be even more dangerous for them?
Yep, and Sue, that's exactly what folks said in San Diego. We're worried about that exact thing happening, and the data showed the opposite. Not only did fewer women die, lots fewer women died, reporting rates went up, and recidivism rates went down dramatically, which was predictable because we know that abusive, controlling men don't bother to intimidate and threaten and beat the hell out of women for the purpose of causing the dismissal of criminal charges against them if they know it's not going to get them anywhere. So that's what the data showed. And that fear that you just described, though it's a common sentiment, is completely unfounded and not supported by the data. And no surprise, Massachusetts has a consistently high rate of homicide caused against women based on gender, which brings me to my second point that no one seems to give a damn about in Massachusetts in terms of leadership, from Deval Patrick to Martha Coakley to Jane Doe. Everybody needs to ask and answer the question, why is gender not included in the list of hate crimes? If you are beaten or attacked based on fill in the blank, anything, ethnicity, race, religion, sexual orientation, that is considered a special crime that we think of as a crime against society and equality and citizenship, as well as the crime against the person. Every type of person is in the list except women. 28 states in this country include gender. Massachusetts, the self-proclaimed progressive Northeast that we think we are, excludes gender, which is an overt act of subjugation endorsed by government officials.
Okay, well, we don't have the gender thing in there now. That's absolutely clear. But my question to you, Wendy Murphy, author of Injustice for Some, is this Remy character had a long record, accusations and problems with two women involving violent situations before. This woman goes, the victim in this case, Jennifer Marchell, goes to get a restraining order, says he smashed her head into a mirror. I don't understand why, in this case, the Middlesex County District Attorney didn't hold this guy looking at this record. They said they looked at his record, didn't hold a dangerousness hearing looking at this case. You hate to bring in the fact that he's the son of Jerry Remy, but this gives it obviously more notoriety because Jerry Remy was a famous baseball player. He's with the Red Sox. He's a famous broadcaster. He's a restaurateur. He's got restaurants. So a famous person's kids involved, there's always more publicity about it. So I don't get why, in this case, with Jerry Remy's kid before them looking like a man mountain Dean, so big he couldn't even fit into the patrol car, they don't say to themselves, we better be erring on the side of caution here. Why not?
Well, you know, on some level, your question is just so rhetorical because the answer is built into everything you just said. It would be nice to believe that who this kid is had nothing to do with the decision, but this is a guy who may have been on the drug called steroids. I think he was on the drug called entitlement. If you just look at his record, that revolving door at the courthouse was a gift that kept giving to him over and over. It didn't matter what he did. He kept getting a pass.
But people who aren't wealthy and famous get the same.
Don't get it to the same degree. No, they
do
get it.
So?
You're right. They do get it, but not to the same degree as this guy did. His record is so
Look at Alimony, though, Wendy. Yeah. Look at Alimony, the kid who allegedly the young man who allegedly killed Amy Lord. He wasn't famous. He was out for years with a very violent past.
Yeah, no, there's no question men, especially men who target women, get a gift, but he got a big gift. And let me say this, because people have said to me, and I like Marion Ryan. I recently
She's a
had
district attorney of Middlesex
she's
County.
She's a Middlesex. I've worked for her for years. I consider her a friend. I've had fights with her about how she handles certain cases. She always takes responsibility. I had a political event for her a couple weeks ago, and I said to the crowd when I introduced her, she knows that I'm here to support her because she's the only woman DA and we need women DAs in the state. But if she doesn't do right by women and children, I will publicly criticize her. And here we are 2 weeks later. But people said, well, so did Marion Ryan drop the ball? I said, drop the ball? She spiked it. You know?
Wendy,
I mean,
what about
is so embarrassing for her because she is a good prosecutor. She cares about this stuff. I have no doubt this is eating her up inside. And look, people tell me that when this kid was in high school and getting in trouble, he would do the ding-a-ling to daddy and get out of it time and time again. When he was arrested and living in Waltham, he sometimes gave Waltham cops his father's million-dollar mansion address in Weston. He didn't even live there.
How do you know this?
I looked at the tape. They're publicly available.
Okay.
The complaint's on file with the court. And the police noted in one of their reports that he was giving multiple addresses and including his father's address and not even giving his father's address correctly.
Wendy, I think a lot of people are now, unfortunately, learning. You know, they think that someone does something violent and bad and they immediately go to jail. And now with these recent cases, we're seeing that you can have a very long violent history and still be walking the streets. Does this beg the question that we really need to stop worrying about these small drug crimes and
yes,
this crazy
I think so.
And really
Let
start
the pot
focusing?
Dealers go.
No, I mean, really, the cops are spending their time chasing after really low level unimportant things and locking people up. You know, our prisons are filled with people who have alcohol and drug abuse problems. And not that doesn't impact into violent crime, but at the same time, you've got violent offenders who are just walking the streets.
I'm voting for you, Sue. Whatever you run for. No, you're 100% right. And if we subjected to some kind of Democratic vote, the question, will we trade this bed in a prison cell for this guy and, you know, put the drug guy out and put this guy in? Everybody would say yes. Put this perpetrator of child rape or violence against women. We in a moral sense, would say yes. But we have a system that reflects our political values, and women are not valued. The lives of women are not valued. In Massachusetts and on average across the country, less than 2% of rapists spend even one day behind bars in this country. That number hasn't changed in 30 years.
All right, Wendy Murphy. I'll be calling you for fundraising. Wendy Murphy is a legal expert and former prosecutor. Her latest book is And Justice for Some. Wendy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much. That was great.
We're going to take your calls now. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970 at Boston Public Radio.
Well, I think the essential question here is, should the woman who takes out the restraining order be the deciding factor in whether or not the prosecution goes ahead with a prosecution? If people don't know, this young man had a very long and violent history. As I said before, he smashed this latest woman that he allegedly killed, Jennifer Martell's head, into a mirror in the home that they shared with their 4-year-old kid. She calls the cops. He gets taken down to the station. He's booked, and he is released. So she's and if you saw
now,
this,
you would think there would be an automatic restraining order. You know, that's, well, there are parts of this that just don't make practical.
He did have a restraining order, but it wasn't, you know, he was out of jail. And okay. with orders, you have to stay away from this woman. Stay away from this woman. So she went to one house and spent the night there. One night, then she goes to a different house and spends the night there the second night. And then she is killed on Thursday. So should it be up to the victim? I am with Wendy Murphy on this. I think it should not be up to the victim because I think it's too frightening. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Jerry Leone used to be the district attorney in Middlesex County. He's no longer there. We have a different DA over in Middlesex County who's taking a lot of heat for this case. Her name is Marion Ryan. Wendy Murphy says she's a great prosecutor. I don't know her from Adam, but this is a very distressing case. Did they handle this correctly? Should they have ignored what the victim wanted, which is in this case apparently no extension of the restraining order, and gone ahead and held this guy in jail?
Listen
to his record. Back in 1998, Remy was charged with destruction of property belonging to the mother of his son. He would soon become, this is from the Boston Globe, he would soon become a frequent presence in the courthouse for charges that included possessing a hypodermic needle and hitting a woman in the head with a beer bottle in Waltham in 2003. But most of the charges between 2002 and 2005 involved his ex-girlfriend. Assaults, threats, violating restraining orders, threatened to kill her at least twice. And in 2004, she found him cutting up her clothing and pictures with the scissors after the fight. The following year, he accepted responsibility for punching and kicking her until she ran to a neighbor's house. Now, okay, that was 2004. It's now 2013. So you can say he was under control for 9 years. But this is very distressing that this person comes before the courts and then is sent out without bail, without anything but a restraining order. And as everybody knows about the restraining order, the line is they're a piece of paper.
And what about why not an automatic dangerousness hearing? I mean, what's so special about that that you have to ask for it? I think that if you're in court and someone's asking for a restraining order, you know, there's already evidence that you are dangerous in some way. So,
I mean, if you have a history of violence, random violence or violence against women or behaving like a nut on the street and attacking people violently, it seems to me that's what a dangerousness hearing is for. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Let's start with Matt in the car. Hi, Matt.
How are you, ladies?
Great.
Great to hear you, Marjorie. Nice to hear you on the radio.
Thank you.
This Remy kid, I mean, you know, not trying to talk about somebody who has a physical stature like he does and have, you know, a foregone opinion about him, but this kid was going to do it anyway. It didn't matter if there was a restraining order on him. The guy's an animal who can't control his impulses. But I do agree that there should be a no-drop law. I think it needs to be taken out of the hands of people that are being intimidated and so on.
You know, Matt, I think you're right on, unfortunately, on that both points. But to the point, though, if these aren't going to work, you know, what can we do? If you've got someone who is a violent domestic abuser, how do we protect the victims? And it doesn't happen just, you know, it's just in against women. It happens against men. It happens in same-sex couples. It happens in many. It happens with elderly people and their children and vice versa. What can we do to protect the victims?
The sad part about this, really, the sad part, and they're all, 90% of these guys are known to law enforcement as violent people. They have rap sheets a mile long, and it needs to be a no-drop that you were talking about, the no-drop law. I completely agree with that. Not because, you know, it's not left up to the individual person to be enforcing these laws. We have to take it out of the hands of those people. I completely agree with the woman you just had on. I'm completely in agreement with that.
Matt, thank you very much for the call. That was Wendy Murphy, who has been a prosecutor herself and done a lot of great work as a victim advocate, and her book is Injustice for Some. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Anonymous is calling from Plymouth County. Hi, Anonymous.
Hi, I'm anonymous because I'm a therapist that works in Plymouth County, and I've been working with a woman who is going through a divorce. Her husband has been verbally and physically abusive, and she finally called the police. They came. He was actually resisting arrest. They filed charges. The day they were supposed to go to court, she was totally there to testify. Her teenage children wanted to testify. And not only did her husband's attorney pressure her to drop the charges, but the DA pressured her as well, saying, how will you get child support if your ex-husband is in jail?
And, wow. You know, what
your kids through this.
What was the motive of the district attorney to, he can't be that worried about her child support problems. What was the real motive of him, Anonymous?
I think because this is a man that did not have an arrest history, that this is a man who, in my estimation, got put over the edge because his wife wanted a divorce and just has been intolerably abusive since then. This has been a long process, several years, but he was never in trouble with the law. So he presents as this poor guy who's a little distressed over a divorce.
You know, I think there is this way of thinking, especially when you get to the courthouse, that if you have a guy who, in their estimation, slips, they don't want it marring his record for the rest of his life.
Right.
And it really, you know, goes to this, let's plead it out, let's dismiss it, you've taught him a lesson. I've heard this from other people as well, not just particularly in this county, but that, you know, to really put it upon the victim that this good guy, quote unquote, is going to be marked for the rest of his life with a violence charge.
Anonymous, did the husband in the divorce case, did he behave himself after the trip to court, or he kept going?
No, he has continued to verbally abuse her, to stalk her, and she is feeling like she cannot go to the police or to the court system now because she will not be supported, and she's scared to death of him. So now she's trying to deal with it on her own. It's a horrible situation. She did everything right.
That's a very discouraging. Yeah. That's a very discouraging and scary call, Anonymous. Thank you for calling in, and I hope things work out. I mean, that is your expectation, obviously, that if something like this happens, you're going to be able to call the police. You're going to be able to call 911. We have made progress. When I was first a reporter 25 years ago, you know, when the cops got to the house, the victim made the decision about whether or not even to arrest the abuser. Thank God that much has changed. Our number is 877-301-8970. Sue O'Connell and I are talking about the case of Jared Remy, a 34-year-old man who is accused of murdering his 27-year-old girlfriend, the mother of their 4-year-old child, with a long history of violence against women. And there was no bail, and he was released the night of the last alleged attack before the actual murder happened. Let's go to Mike from Haverhill. What do you think, Mike?
I want to say up front that I absolutely support doing everything we can to help victims, to put guys who abuse women in jail, to punish them. However, I object strongly to the phrase, we've made it a taboo against asking any questions about victims' behavior. The don't blame the victim thing, lest we forget, 3-4 decades ago, when women were raped, we had a Madonna whore complex in this country. We would ask how a woman was dressed.
I think we still do.
Maybe we still do, but don't blame the victim came out of that culture of looking for reasons that sex-seeking behavior by women who were not married, and even frankly by some women who were married, was taboo in this country, and the generalization to say. I will give an example from my own life.
Mm-hmm.
I have a foster sister. She had an abusive boyfriend.
Hold on, Mike. I don't want to go into examples from your own life with all due respect because they're going to get too involved. What is your point in this case? We shouldn't call this dead woman a victim?
No, of course not.
We shouldn't ask questions about what led up to the beating? I mean, is there ever...
No.
What are you saying?
My objection is, to the taboo against blaming the quote-unquote blaming the victim, because we infantilize women when we say, well, I'm not saying anything about these particular victims.
Okay.
But some of the time, in the case of abusive men, the woman goes back again and again and again and saying that she does not have some blame for being abused.
No, but I think I'm glad you called, Mike, because you bring a very important point. I don't think there's any situation in which any person, unless you are being, you know, in a complete self-defense mode, is there ever a situation where you have put yourself where you are being attacked and it's your issue. I just told my two nieces who are going off to college that if they each disregard every bit of advice that we've ever given them about being safe and find themselves in a situation where they have been attacked and they have been drinking or they were out late or they didn't listen to us, to not think that they are responsible for what happened to them. There's safe yeah. behavior, and there's no justification for anyone to hurt anyone under any circumstances.
It's, right.
It doesn't mean you can't ask how it happened.
Yeah.
But,
no, it's best not to go to the guy's room you hardly met after you've both had like a case of beer apiece.
Right. But if you do and something happens
it's
to you.
Not, yes, right. No, right. Absolutely right. Let's take a couple more calls here and then we're going to move on. 877-301-8970. Should we take the onus away from the victim? And in this case, she was the victim. Her head was smashed into the mirror before she was murdered. Away from deciding if they are going to further the prosecution and keep a restraining order. Alice in the car. What do you think, Alice?
You know, I think what was interesting to me was, you know, that this was a man who'd had previous, obviously, many violent incidents in the past, but just recently one at their apartment, and their daughter was present. So why wouldn't, mm-hmm. I mean, should DCF have played a role, a bigger role, I guess is a question for me, and could they have? I mean, she sounds, from all the accounts, it sounds like she was a pretty dedicated mom, so perhaps if there was a threat that, you know, her daughter could be taken away or, you know, or perhaps that he couldn't live in the home, that she might have taken more aggressive steps to get out of that.
Yeah, that is a part of it. Like, at what point is the safety of, does DCF see it as the safety of the child and the safety of the family? And, you know, why is it okay for a dad who has been violent against the mom to still, you know, for that family not to be in the DCF system, I guess is what you're
yeah.
asking, right?
Is there any automatic trigger in that kind of thing? If there's a...
Well, someone has to call. Start? Someone has to report it.
But
someone has
be,
to call and report that that there's something going on and there's a 51A and somebody comes in and investigates and all that. But you know something, Alice? I think... you're in such desperate straits by the time you get to the Department of Children and Families, and they are so overwhelmed. I mean, there was just a piece in the paper, but what do they got now? 25 cases apiece, and it's, you know, good foster homes. I mean, there are some good ones,
but
there are some bad ones.
To the college
why
point,
is this
though,
kid in DSF at all? Why isn't she in the daughter's parent? Why is she still in a foster home? I don't get that either.
Well, probably, I don't know. But you think that if it goes through into another system, that it will bring attention to the family, so...
Okay. Can we take one more call here
and then we're
going? Eileen from Hingham. What do you think, Eileen?
Well, I'm going to be the person that speaks up for non-mandatory prosecutions today.
Okay.
I understand the idea behind it. I also think there's reasons women are staying with men that are abusive, and that reason isn't just that they're stupid and they like getting beaten up. It's they have children that they can't support on their own. And I think you do really run a risk of people not calling the cops at all when their life is in danger, because they don't want to be put through a prosecution. They don't want to face this guy in court. Or this guy is their means of support, and they don't want to see him thrown in jail.
Yeah.
And I used to work in a part of the country. I used to be a reporter for NPR in rural Alaska. I mean, this was a real fear. People would not call the cops. There was a very small, very insular community off the road system. People were afraid of the societal sanction they were going to get. They were afraid to call the police to have these people arrested. And I appreciate your experts' data on San Diego. I just point out that's one city. That's not a large enough data set to draw
Eileen, the thing but the incredible part is what you're saying here is it's okay for it, not okay.
No, it's the only choice.
But I don't think it is the only choice. I don't think it's a very good thing for a kid to witness that.
What's the social organization that we have to support these women after they call the cops in this process?
Well, you have the worst case scenario is homeless shelters. And I'm not saying that's a great place to be, but there are, I think you'd be better off in a shelter than in a house with that kind of violence.
And I'm saying that's not an easily foregone conclusion to draw. I'm saying we have a very good legal system and not a great social support system for people with kids who are trying to get out of abusive relationships. It's why leaving an abusive relationship, that's the most dangerous time.
I mean,
we don't have
I think
great support.
I think what you find,
I think forcing prosecutions is a little bit dangerous.
My mom was a family advocate for Head Start in Revere, Winthrop, and Chelsea. And she would, you know, often say, as were members of my family who are in law enforcement, that you really have to have taking the kid out of the home be the very last resort. And it's the same with, you know, a domestic abuse issue, because it will totally, you know, as if violence isn't fracturing the family enough, sometimes it will fracture it even worse. So you have to find a way to solve the violence, prevent the violence, and keep the child in the home. And that's, to the caller's point, the social systems we have to do this are overwhelmed, as we just said.
But, I mean, the bottom line for me, and Eileen, thank you for the call, is we're saying something very awful when we're saying that,
and true,
if you get if your next door neighbor runs you over and he's drunk in the car, and you say, "Well, gee, I don't want to prosecute him because I like him; he's my next door neighbor." They're not going to say, "Well, we're not going
to
prosecute."
Yeah, but if you don't show up to testify, what happens? They can test. I mean,
the case might be dismissed down the road, but at least they're going to start a prosecution. And I don't think that we want to have this not going on in these domestic violence cases.
Well, this unfortunately will be a conversation we continue here at Boston Public Radio. I want to thank Wendy Murphy, who was with us. She's a legal expert. Her new book is Justice and Justice for Some. And when we come back, it's open mic time with Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hi, it's Marjorie Egan inviting you to the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival, Chef's Gala Reception, Thursday, September 19th. It's your chance to indulge in the finest food cooked up right in front of you by some of New England's best celebrity chefs. You could even ask them for their secret ingredients, although they may not tell you, but act fast. Space is limited. Secure your tickets at wgbh.org/festival. Hope you can make it.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick or at DoverRug.com. And Leahy Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LeahyHealth.org. That's LeahyHealth.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Gene Rivers is already bursting at the seams. He's here with us every Monday for Open Mic. We'll get to you in just a second, Gene Rivers. We have to just explain that Jim Browdy outrageously is still on vacation. Oh, Sue O'Connell, though,
how's
thank
he get
God.
That?
So
listen,
it's
some
unbelievable.
People are like, they expect him to come back all zen and centered. And, you know.
Okay. Well, Sue O'Connell.
So RJ's laughing at that.
Yeah, that's not
going to
happen. A zen Jim? I don't think so.
No.
Sue O'Connell is filling in, though, for Jim, and we appreciate that very much. She's from Bay Windows and South End News. And Sue O'Connell wrote a piece last week that caused a mini uproar on the pages of
I feel
Bay
like
Windows.
Gene Rivers. Everyone's mad at me.
That's right.
Welcome to the club.
talking about the common experiences of white gay men and black men, you're still getting trashed. So we thought it would be a good time.
That, actually. Yeah, I grabbed that when I was in a Brattle Street bookstore.
Well, thank you.
Very
thank
interesting.
You.
Hats off to you.
Thank you.
Big
so
time.
let's talk about it. Sue, explain yourself
well,
and
my
Gene,
issue,
you tell us if she's right or wrong.
There's one premise I believe, and this is not related to race or anything. I really believe other people can feel what other people are feeling. I can feel your pain. This whole idea of people saying, you don't know how I feel. Yes, you can.
Yeah,
you can feel
humans.
How other people
Come
feel.
On.
Also, I don't, as much as I respect and call the civil rights movement of the African-American people in America the civil rights movement, it's also an American civil rights movement, just not for African-Americans. And a lot of the strategy was not invented by African-Americans. It was invented,
True.
Like, in page 2 of the Bible. You know, people have been doing this as long as they've been doing
this. You know, I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam and Eve were doing that? What was page 2 of the Bible?
Let's start with Exodus.
That would be a better one.
Let's start with Exodus, which is probably one of the most important political texts for at least 1,000 years of European history. Exodus.
Exodus, absolutely.
Okay.
The whole liberation struggle movement. Oh, no, it's amazing.
White men, white gay men who have been the devil for a very long time. They were called AIDS spreaders. They were called pedophiles.
You threw me there for a minute.
Not just the white devil. They were, for better or worse, the public face of the gay movement.
Right.
And they went basically in the past 10 years from being labeled pedophiles to being the person you want living next door to you, right? Mm-hmm. How did that happen? Well, one of them was the normalization of gay people. They live next to you. They're not all, you know, complete sex maniacs. Some of them are, but most of them aren't. You know, we have not demonized.
Didn't hear that from me.
We have not demonized the queer people in our movement, but we have shown you the accountants and the teachers and the librarians and the boring gays. I simply said in a column, why can't African-American young men in particular take a page from white gay men in particular and find a way to normalize their existence? That's all. No change. Keep wearing your hoodies.
So what
do whatever
think,
you want.
Jean?
Go to Scituate where all the white people are and have brunch. Buy a sweater. Don't be normal. Normalize your existence. People got really mad at me.
I don't get it. I literally don't get that.
A lot of criticism was that I didn't give enough due to the civil rights movements of, you know, the folks that invented to their idea the types of protests. Some people thought that my idea of going to buy a sweater in Scituate was mundane. I pointed out sitting at a lunch counter could be mundane. Sitting on a bus could be, you know, mundane. But more importantly, you know, someone called me a nice white lady, which my family was so thrilled that I was finally called a nice white lady.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. That, you know, can white people talk about race openly? And how we, you know, we talk about race in a different way off the air than we do on the air. We have a credibility between each other. But can we start openly talking about how we talk?
Well, actually, you make an excellent point. And part of the difficulty is that within the black community, we have what I must be called kind of black political thought police. And there's certain forms of discourse that are unacceptable or just incorrect. And I think your point is very well taken. What the gay community has done, and by which I mean really the white gay community, is that they played a brilliant game. They took, actually, some interesting pages out of the civil rights game, because what is unique about King and the stuff that we're going to sort of commemorate this upcoming week is that King's genius is that he wraps the argument not in grievance or anger, which was justified because the South was a totalitarian apartheid regime. By any empirically, you know, by any neutral measurement, right? If totalitarian societies are closed societies with authoritarian regimes, the South was a totalitarian apartheid system. Now, with that said, the genius of King is that he says, you know what? I've got every reason to burn down the damn place, the whole thing, but I'm not. Because that's, one, suicidal. Two, theologically, I don't believe it. Three, black people are not there. And four, we have an institution that whose moral authority we're going to leverage and combine it with an American narrative. So we've got Exodus on the one hand, we've got the Declaration of Independence on the other, and we've got Thoreau and Rousseau, and King pulled together something that was unprecedented. And it's actually, one quick point on this, you know what's fascinating about all the King business? If you were to read the American Political Science Review in 1950, or the American Journal of Sociology, those are all your fancy academic people, no one saw Montgomery, 1955, the black church in an obscure little town coming.
Mm-hmm.
No one,
mm-hmm.
because the intelligentsia was entirely secular. There was no religion was dead, essentially, right?
Right.
And out of some obscure place, a 26-year-old kid with a PhD from Boston School of Theology, you know, a Baptist preacher launches an apartheid movement using sacred institutions that serve secular purposes.
Now, Bayard Rushton, of course, who has worked with Martin Luther King, who was gay.
He was a gay guy.
Oh, yeah,
gay guy.
Oh, yeah.
Totally worked behind
time.
The scenes.
They were worried about him all the time.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's... No. Well, he worried... everybody worried about Bayard.
And he's getting the Medal of... the President's Medal of Freedom coming up. Yeah. It's finally being honored. But, I mean, it's really... You know, the thing that is... The pessimistic reality of communities of color and minority color, groups, that you have always been treated bad, so you expect people to treat you bad. And it's a legitimate, valid feeling.
Yeah.
What I was curious about is how do we move from suspicion to skepticism? You know, I'm all for skepticism. I'm all about tearing it down, find out what it is, but without suspicion. And obviously we're not in the spot where you shouldn't have suspicion.
Yeah. Touche. I mean, see, there is this presumption of guilt, which is your point about suspicion. There's a presumption of bad will, which is unfair. And see, now part of this revolves around you have to convene collections of adults to have an adult conversation that says reasonable individuals can differ on this subject. And if you disagree, you're not a bad person. This does not confirm my suspicion of bad will. And the other part of it is there's got to be generosity, which is sort of part of having civilized discourse. Mm-hmm. You got to be generous. You got to presume that the person that you disagree with in some very fundamental way is not a bad person, mm-hmm. but simply has a contrary view. Now, black people, I'm going to go to the black people part of this, right? Part of the genius that was lost, and I got an interesting spin on this for you. Part of what happens is that by 65, the black movement goes secular. It moves from the South to the North. And the generosity which characterizes King at his best morally, politically, and is a testament to his genius is lost. So now everything becomes an ideological zero-sum game, mm-hmm. where if you say something that is counterintuitive or challenges some fundamental presupposition or premise about my politics, I say you're a racist, which is crazy.
Hold on. Why was it lost in 65? Because it moved to the North? I mean, Steve was still talking about Jesus and stuff until he died.
Not even so much the Jesus thing. What King does is that in a very big tent inclusive way, he draws on the best of these religious traditions. And they were traditions that every American could resonate with, so that secular Jewish intellectuals from New York
could join
mm-hmm. and feel good. You know, he's working Jesus, he's working Moses. Well, we can do that, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And Gandhi. And he makes it palatable to a secular audience. Now, when that was lost, and because watch how we pivot. We pivot from King. There's this ugly transitional period. The next thing you look up, we're talking about Black Power and the Black mm-hmm, Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And then they say, burn this mother down.
You know, and it's a hard thing. And I think from the gay experience too, Marjorie, it's a hard thing when you're in it and you're fighting for your civil rights to think you're going to compromise.
Yeah,
you know, it's very difficult. But you know, we're talking about the Employment Discrimination Act, which still hasn't passed in Congress. And it didn't include transgender folks. And we were, as a gay community, political community, well, do we cut them from the train in order to move it forward, or do we bring them on, keep them on the train so that we can get it passed? And you're dealing with people's lives. So it's easy to get angry. It's to touch into your anger.
I thought one of the big points of your piece was that if more black kids are running around in jackets and ties like they were during this. Well, I thought that was a legitimate piece, though, because I think that there is.
Well, let me say something about that. Now, actually,
I mean, you might agree with it, but I think.
All right. No, she wasn't making that argument. But actually, you raise an important point. You see, part of what's going on here is that there is this naive idea that we're going to have a perfected state and that there aren't compromises because, you know, S doesn't happen. Life happens. Life happens, right? And the reality is, frankly, let me tell you something. I tell young black boys, contrary to, you know, my five, you know, revolutionary brothers that all meet in Harvard Square Starbucks, right, to overthrow, you know, like Pinky in the Brain, right? Well, what are we going to do tomorrow? Well, we always do, take over the world, right? No, that young black men have to be trained how to negotiate a larger world, which is not going to have people to love you. In fact, as the Trayvon Martin thing recedes, I'm working with some people, and we're going to do this Beyond Trayvon. How do we begin to train young black boys to negotiate a world that in many cases they have been trained to negotiate? And unfair as it is, listen, dude, you know, we've got 500 years of accumulated racism. You're not going to change it tomorrow. And brother, you better understand how you negotiate that reality and stop whining and complaining because the world's not a perfect place and not everybody loves you.
You know, the other
so
thing.
Should you wear jackets and ties?
Yes, they should. You know, let me tell you something. I told my son, you better not come out this house with the pants hanging off your butt, you know, on some, I'm free. Dude, I said, listen, I said, you don't do that. Yeah. What you do is you're going to comport yourself in a certain way. You don't dart abruptly up and down in the financial district. You just some young black dude, and you can run down the street like you're, you know, no, dude. You're going to negotiate this with a sense of realism. And not everything got to be a protest. You got to negotiate imperfect circumstances and do the reasonable thing.
I actually think that it's important for people to know that I am suspect of almost every young man between the ages of 15 and 22.
Yeah,
all
that makes
men,
sense.
All men.
I'm less suspect if they're in a jacket and tie. I must admit.
Yeah.
And they're busy taking. Yeah. They're the bankers and they're robbing.
Yeah. No. That's when they get 30.
Listen, line this. It's become a big burning issue here in the city of Boston. The minority officers are very, very upset with Ed Davis, who's the commissioner of Boston Police, think that they're, and the statistics bear them out, there are not a lot of African-American men or men of any kind of color, or women for that matter, in the higher ranks of the police department. Now, you're working on this, Gene Rivers. What's happening?
I'm not a racial person, you know, and I don't do the black anger, free mumia, clenched fist thing, but the black police officers, and I've talked to officers within the minority organization and those who don't even play politics, across the board in this town, there is a smoldering tension because black officers feel, just based on numbers, there is something that is racially separate in promotion, hiring, and discipline that makes no sense. I want to say for the rest, and I must point out, I am surprised that not one of the white candidates running for mayor has said a word about that.
Well, actually, I hosted a forum at Boston.com last week, and I brought up the PAC Centurion issue, which is the not union authorized but union newspaper that Chris Ferrone wrote about in the Boston Phoenix last year or the year before, about all the racism and misogyny that was in it that no one spoke about because it wasn't the official thing. Everybody gets it delivered to them, but no one spoke about how awful it was. And, you know, what about the union is doing this? This is a, you know, you have a very unfair, I think, across the board, unfair way of promotion. And the result
it's
has
civil
been...
civil service, correct?
Yeah. And the result has been that white men primarily have gone forward. And this has been, whenever I run into some of my law enforcement friends, go, oh, I would be lieutenant, except I'm a white guy. And I go, really? How's that going? Obviously, you're pretty stupid because you can't, these other white guys are getting there.
No.
So it's unfair across the board, and the union has been silent on it.
No, and see, the other part of this, let me just, for the record, Edward Davis, who I worked with in Lowell before he got to Boston, is a great guy. He's a great guy.
He cares a lot. Yep.
He cares a lot. And there is a system over which he presides, which, if not in intent, in effect, is racist. Because you've got these black officers, male and female, that have been experiencing significant differences. Listen, in the Lord case, when the young woman was murdered,
Amy Lord, in South Boston,
right? There was a black officer who got toe up from the flow up for dropping the ball.
Right.
Fair enough.
The detective.
Now, the problem was there were white supervising officers who got a pass. She said, whoa, dude, wait a minute. If the black officer didn't do his job, maybe he should be going after stolen cars and not doing homicide. Fair enough. So he gets a demotion. But why was there no justice meted out to the white officers? And there is the perception borne out by experience among every... I was at a Boston Red Sox game hanging out with my buddy Charles Ogletree last night, right? I ran into a black officer. Yeah, right, exactly, right? And he came up to me and said, look, Red Rivers, I don't mess with the Mamleo minority officers group, but across the board, to the last person, there is the perception of racism and discrimination in hiring, promotion, and discipline.
So what's going to happen?
Well, one, I am calling for a federal investigation, and we want to go to Eric Holder and say, Eric Holder, if no one in Boston gives a damn about justice and fairness for black officers, how can we possibly expect black kids to think they will get a break? If a black law enforcement person is suffering discrimination, how am I going to convince a black kid from not breaking the law that he's going to get a fair shot? And so, listen, we're going to, some clergy and some other community activists are going to write an open letter appealing to Eric Holder to investigate this thing, because it has been going on for a long time. We see it being played out in investigations. Does anyone believe that if the black girls on Harlem Street who were murdered last year were white, that we would still be talking about not having one suspect?
Mm-hmm. So should Commissioner Davis be gone?
You know what? Let me think about that, because okay. I don't want to. I don't want to play the game.
No,
I want to be fair.
Yeah, I mean it's an.
Yeah, because then what do I get, right? Yeah, the cherubic police commissioner who dropped the ball on this may be better than a less cherubic person who is not as friendly to black folk. I'm not sure about that, but what I will say is this: there needs to be a investigation to assess the objective merits of the question of racial discrimination in hiring, promotion, and firing that the black officers have been subjected to.
So when Eric Holder does nothing, and he's been famous for doing not much of anything in some people's minds as the Attorney General of the United States of America, what happens then?
Now, we need to turn up the heat on Eric Holder and lean on him so that he is pushed to do the right thing, as has traditionally been the case for him to get off the dime on a number of issues.
Thank you, Reverend Eugene Rivers III. He joins us every Monday at 1 for Open Mic. Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock. It's Open Mic time with Charlie Baker. So how much are you willing to pay for a babysitter? In Massachusetts, they're making an hourly rate that rivals what some white-collar workers are pulling in. Do you get what you pay for? The conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
They grow dense in the California mountains, and under the right conditions, this shrub can be a firefighter's worst nightmare.
So it is a carpet of gasoline. People should think of it in those terms. And if they did so, they would think twice before they would want to live in a landscape that produces this kind of disturbance frequently.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, Deadly Fire Zones, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Bentley University. Bentley University Center for Career Services is the reason that within 6 months of commencement, over 95% of Bentley graduates have either been hired or accepted to graduate programs. Bentley, the business university. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows is filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. I'm Marjorie Egan. Okay, time to give new
Let's
respect.
Let's get serious now.
Yeah, well, not so serious. A little not so serious break here. Time to give new respect to that kid, you know, the college kid who's been taking care of your kids for years, because I did not know this until a few days ago, but the only job around practically where salaries are rising higher than inflation is babysitting. The average cost of a babysitter is $12 in Boston. Sometimes people are getting as much as $20 an hour. That is the babysitter. So I want to know from you mothers and fathers out there with young kids, I guess, you know, unless you're a hedge fund manager and his wife, you can't go out anymore because the babysitter is costing you $10, $12, $15 an hour. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. I want to know, how are you surviving this? Now, Sue O'Connell, you have a young kid. Is she old enough to leave alone?
She is now. And I got to tell you, it was really being a single parent and having a lot of night work obligations, not even talking about fun. I mean, you know, I had to pay. I had an overnight babysitter one night because I had an early morning meeting and a late night meeting. And
how much did that cost?
Oh, it was ridiculous. It was, I'm of two minds with it. It's your kid, right? You want to hire someone who you're paying a good wage to, who's going to not think, oh, I'm just going to text all day because I'm only making $9 an hour. How much should you pay a person who's, you know, going to take care of? And this was a young adult, someone in college. It wasn't a kid. So I actually paid her less for sleeping, you know. But, you know, she had to get up and get my kid to school. And you know, I think it was like $15 an hour if she was sleeping and $18 an hour, you know, because it was this huge thing. For the sort of like, afternoon, I actually hired my mother-in-law, the grandmother, to babysit for $10 an hour because...
Gave you a deal.
She did give me a deal, you know. And I think it's, you know, I know we have had other conversations about this, but I like paying people because it makes it clear, you know, you're not doing me a favor, you're getting paid, you show up.
No, I guess. It just seems somehow it's not right that you pay a babysitter who generally is a teenager.
Right.
Sometimes they are the college graduate.
But you can't find the teenagers.
Because they're too busy studying for their SATs.
They're too busy. I mean, I did the whole, you know, I live in the suburbs. I put the thing up. I've gone on city.com, all those crazy things. But they're busy. The kids don't work the way that we, and this is not a judgment. They just don't work the way that we did. I mean, I had 3 or 4 babysitting jobs. Even when I was in sixth grade, I was a mother's helper. Do they even have mother's helpers
anymore? Okay, if the minimum wage is about $8 and you send your kid to a daycare center, are the daycare workers getting more or less money than the babysitter who's at home? I would guess the daycare workers are getting less.
They're probably getting less, but they're probably also getting health care, and it's like a real
job. Let's hope so.
And they also have, you know, the thing about the babysitter is it's a once-in-a-while thing or an every-Friday thing, so they're going to ask for more. I did know a number of parents who were sharing a babysitter, like they had a Friday night babysitter or a Saturday night, and the three families would drop the kid. They weren't a lot of kids, but drop the kids, and they would all go. They didn't have to go out together. They would go their separate ways and have one babysitter. But then you find that they don't want to share the names with you because they don't want to compete against you on Saturday night. I mean, I actually hired a babysitter from a friend who lived in a totally different city, and I paid her. Actually, I did this twice. I paid them
to fly her in?
To drive in from, like, you know, the western part of the 128 to drive in.
I paid them $10 an hour on the Mass Pike?
Yes, because that's how desperate I was. So I get it.
877-301-8970.
I'm also thinking about becoming a babysitter.
That's
whenever
right.
I'm thinking about, like, you know, I think I need another job.
Yeah, well, that's one of the points in the story is that everybody's making fun of the fact that they've got college graduates babysitting, but the college graduates are making more money as babysitters than they are in a lot of other
jobs. You're better off sending them to tutoring. Because it's not that much more expensive, and they actually are getting tutored, and you can still go, you know, get a 3-hour tutoring session at one of the chains.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Are we paying these babysitters too much, or is, you know, $16, $18, $20 an hour just the going rate to take care of your precious little nubbins while you and your husband are out having margaritas somewhere? Let's go to Courtney in Hyde Park. What do you think, Courtney?
Well, I babysit for a few families, and I think that the price is really justified because, like, you're paying for the confidence that that individual is going to take care of your kids. They're going to be safe when they come home. And, you know, you hear about a lot of weird stuff that happens with nannies. You know, remember that nanny in New York City who murdered?
Oh, please. Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
thank you.
Families have incentive to hold on to a good babysitter. And you start to sort of regard those families as, like, friends of yours. And, like, you really, I don't know, my family that I babysit for, I've considered, like, changing my schedule to make sure I can babysit for them.
Courtney, how old are you?
Well, I'm 22.
You're 22 and you're in college? You're just out of college?
I am a college graduate. I graduated a year ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, that's one of the points in this piece is that a lot of people, Courtney, like yourself, that are college graduates are babysitting because they can make more money babysitting than they can in some of the paltry jobs that are available now. And I bet the kids you babysit for aren't brats, are they, Courtney?
Babysitting than I do at my regular job.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. Rebecca in Worcester, what do you think about $18 an hour for the babysitter?
I say it's worth it. It depends on who you have, but it's I pay about $20 to my babysitter, and I trust her, and these are my kids she's taking care of, so it's worth it. And she definitely makes herself available when I need her.
Rebecca, what about the idea, and I saw this happen before I had a child, but that the moms, and it's usually the moms, I hate to generalize, but it's usually the moms get together and agree how much they're going to pay so that the babysitters can't push up the rate. Like if one, are you worried that your other parent friends are going to be angry with you because you're paying well?
I don't care. I, as long He makes himself available to me when I need her.
I love you, Rebecca. I don't care.
I mean, I'm a registered nurse, and she's almost, you know, making what I'm making, but I don't care.
Somehow that doesn't seem right,
yeah,
Rebecca, that you're a registered nurse, and she's an expertise, and she's making as much as
you know, but you have one emergency with your kid, and it really does sort of drive the point home. I mean, the one emergency my child had when I wasn't there, she was actually with our very good friends from you know, our neighbors and friends, so it worked out okay, but... You know, you don't want some basket case taking care of your kid when they break their arm. I mean...
No, but sometimes it's hard to tell who the basket cases are. You know, they look good when they first show up. And suddenly they're inviting over all the guys they played chess with at Harvard Square into your house. You know, then you're in big trouble.
I think you've got a personal experience you want to share, Marjorie.
Let's take one more call. Celeste from Needham. What do you think, Celeste?
Hi. Well, first, I just want to say hi to Sue. Sue, you are good friends with my sister, Renee.
Oh, okay. Oh, hi. Hi, Celeste. How are you?
Good, love. How are you?
Well, thank you. Blast from the past.
It's so nice to hear your voice on the radio.
Thanks, Celeste.
I just want to say that I think that the babysitters are totally justified in making that money. My daughter babysits, and it is a never-ending stream of social monitoring, food allergies, driving kids around. You know, making sure that they're covered, sunscreen. I mean, it's like nonstop, the list of things those people have to do, which I'm sure I wanted those same things done when my children were being babysat. So I don't have any problem with the kids earning a good wage. I really don't. Even though it's cutting into, you know, adults are making less than that, it requires a certain amount of patience and
capacity
to be a babysitter.
When we were growing up in Revere and we were babysat, I don't remember the babysitters paying that much attention to us.
No, I had a very shady crew in my house. Very shady.
But what did we get?
Not very much.
$5, $4.
$2, $3, $7.
And then the creepy dad would drive you home.
Oh, yeah, the creepy dad.
Oh, boy.
Would you like to tell a story about any creepy dads here?
No, I don't want to tell. I know who they are, though, the creepy dad.
Okay.
All my friends would show, including Renee. Celeste, thanks for calling. Renee, we'd all show up if the babysitting was over at 11:30. All my friends would show up so that they would drive me home. So
that's nauseating.
Dads, yeah.
That is nauseating. Okay, so no one agreed that babysitting was making too much money.
No. So obviously we need to become babysitters.
Okay, well, a little weekend, a little extra job in the weekend, go out and make a few bucks. Actually, if it's 20 bucks an hour, you could make like 60 bucks in
Absolutely.
3 hours.
Yes. Yeah, thanks.
Better
no
be
kidding.
A,
and you don't have
fast
to pay
movie.
And you don't have to pay taxes on it. I mean, you should pay taxes. But anyway, okay, so speaking of not paying the taxes, if you don't pay taxes, you go to prison. And the theme of prison has finally made it to the small screen, which shows like my favorite, Orange is the New Black. And it has also been turned into a long-going Hollywood staple. So we've got Whitey Bulger facing the rest of his life behind bars, and film critic Garen Daly joins us to talk about why prison and Hollywood are such a great match. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So far this year, there have been over 30 homicides in the city of Boston.
Shootings may be down, and homicides may be down, but violence is not down.
Whether it's one person or 100 people, it's bad. People are dying.
I'm reporter James Edwards with a series on rising from violence in Boston. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Orchard Cove. Engaging, energizing. These are some of the words residents use to describe this independent senior community in Canton. You can learn more and arrange a tour at orchardcovelive.org. And WGBH 44, Detective Barnaby and Inspector Gently confront the British countryside's most sinister citizens. All new episodes of Midsummer Murders at 8 and Inspector George Gently at 9, Mondays on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell is in with vacationing Jim Browdy. And here with us in Studio 3 is film critic Garen Daly. We're talking about cell block cinema. This is sort of an honor of Whitey Bulger's being in a cell block forevermore. That trial is finally over. And how prison has been a staple for Hollywood films for years. Garen's a producer and director of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. Hey, Garen, thank you very much for being in here today.
My pleasure.
So tell us about cell block cinema, please. Is this about prison breaks, about dismal cells? What are we talking about?
Actually, it's a huge topic when you start thinking about it. When I started looking at it, I found over 300 films that are made about prisons, either in prison, about prisons, escape from prisons, and there's subgenres within it. There's the exploitation women in prison. There's also prisoners of war escaping. Then there are the social messages. So it's a really huge topic.
Wow. So okay, what's your first prison film you're going to tell us about?
Well, I think we should start from the beginning. And it's kind of amazing that the first film that I found was a 1928 silent film from Germany called Sex in Chains, about women in prison.
Yep, yep.
And that is...
Sex and Chains.
I tell you, the whole women... It's sad and true at the same time that, you know, as we learn more in real life about what happens to women when they're in prison and how they're abused and just it's an awful situation. Cinema has known about it since... cinema began.
Well, it's because, one of the things we should always look at when we look at these films, why are there so many films and what makes it work so well? And the first thing is you have a concentration of society in one location in a very tight, confined quarters. You've got either men or women all together. You have got guards who may or may not be corrupt. You usually have a warden who is corrupt. There's all sorts of perverted sex or sex that you would not normally see in the outside. Again, concentrated. So you have all these elements concentrated in one thing. So for Hollywood, it's really easy to see where you can get the tension and how the tension goes. And there, obviously, there are some really excellent prison
films. You know, you make
films.
A good point, though, the word perversion, in the sense that prison life is a perversion of regular life.
Yeah.
You know, it is that, you know, you see people try to mirror what's actually happening on the outside, but it's not quite the same. So the silent film was about women in chains and love and sex. No love or just sex?
I think it was just sex. Okay. I haven't seen it. I just found it. But, the first really big film was called The Big House, which was about a real warden. And this is something you also see in these films, that sometimes they're all based on real wardens. And this warden, his name is James Hallahan. And it's all about how the prisons were corrupt and how they needed to make a new start with prisons. And some of that came out of a real event, which was in 1930. There was a huge fire in an Ohio prison, and the guards would not let the inmates out, and 300 inmates died. And that shocked the nation.
I didn't even know that. Mm-hmm. That's horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But, but I think we should talk about probably one of the best films out there.
What?
That's Frank Darabont's Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, Shawshank Redemption. I just saw it on TV the night. As a matter of fact, we have a clip from Shawshank Redemption. Let's hear the little sound from Shawshank Redemption. Oh, it needs to be set up. Okay, set it up. Can you set this up? Oh, I'm supposed to set it up.
Yeah.
Whoops. Okay, here we go. Tim Robbins, he is the character that's jailed for murdering his wife and her lover. He always maintained his innocence, and in this scene, he approaches the prison warden, a corrupt prison warden, when he finds out that a prisoner had fessed up to his jailmate that he was the one who did the double murder that landed Robbins in jail. Here it is.
Well, let's say for the moment this Blatch does exist. You think he'd just fall to his knees and cry, "Yes, I did it, I confess. Oh, and by the way, had a life term to my sentence."
You know that wouldn't matter. With Tommy's testimony, I can get a new trial.
Well, that's assuming Blatch is even still there. Chances are excellent he'd be released by now.
Well, they'd have his last known address, names of relatives. It's a chance, isn't it? The country club will have his old time cards, records, W-2s with his name on them.
Frayne, if you want to indulge this fantasy, that's your business. Don't make it mine. This meeting is over.
Oh, poor Tim Robbins trying to add, just logic to thinking that he's going to get an answer. It's a great movie.
But think about that. In that very short clip, we got several major themes within prison movies. You have the warden who is unsympathetic and possibly corrupt. Well, we know he's corrupt.
Yeah.
Then you also have Tim Robbins trying to, again, exactly what you said, be logical. But in reality, he's in a world where he has absolutely no control, and he has to accept that he has no control, and then he has to figure out a way to get out.
You know, the great thing about Shawshank Redemption, too, was just how, I mean, I just feel it portrayed so many real-life challenges to prisoners when they get out of jail. You know, the issues of going to work at the grocery store when you get out of jail, and the predators that are in behind bars. There's good guys in jail and bad guys in jail, and just the patience that his character showed in just getting through it and getting out.
That is one of the major themes within all of the prison films. The metal of the person in jail having to maintain their own inner moral code to navigate this very corrupt system. And it even, I mean, think about Cool Hand Luke, mm-hmm. Paul Newman and Cool Hand Luke, where he is in a chain gang because he cut the heads off of parking meters, and which is obviously very 1960s, late 1960s, you know, an attack on the establishment. But he is being forced to do things that he did not want to do.
We have a little sound from Cool Hand Luke. In this scene, Paul Newman is getting shackled. Here it is.
You're going to get used to wearing them chains after a while, Luke. Don't you never stop listening to them clinking. Because they're going to remind you of what I've been saying. For your own good.
Wish you'd stop being so good to me, Captain.
Don't you ever talk that way to me. Never! Never! What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach.
One of the great lines of all time.
Strother Martin at his very, very best. But again, you know, think about what is going on in that scene. You know, the reason that film did very, very well in 1967 was not just because it was Paul Newman, it was well-written and well-directed, but it also tapped into the zeitgeist of the moment where you are being forced, or so you seem, to kowtow to society and to do things that doesn't seem right, yet they're telling you that we have to communicate with each other, which is exactly the opposite of what's going on.
What was the guy's name that played the – was he the warden or just a corrupt –
He was the warden.
He was the warden.
That's Strother Martin.
Yeah, he was a great character, and he was an enraging character, just like the warden in Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm. What,
was
wardens
so
are,
enraging.
All the, yeah. Most of the wardens are really, really bad. There's only a few of them in the movies that are good. One of them being Robert Redford in Brubaker, mm-hmm. which again was based on a real warden who tried to change the Arkansas system.
Huh.
But again, you know, he got kicked out because he was too honest.
So what else you got? We're talking with Garen Daly, by the way. I should reintroduce you. She was talking about the whole theme of, in honor of the Whitey Bulger trial, Whitey's going to jail for the rest of his life, we all presume, even though the sentencing hasn't happened yet, prison movies and escape from prison movies.
And escape from prison. Well, one of my favorites, and it kind of sets up everything else afterwards, is Take the Money and Run. With Woody Allen. Now, you have to understand, with Take the Money and Run, what Woody Allen has done, and he took all of the movies prior to this, all of the prison movies prior to that, and deconstructed them in such a way that it made it absolutely humorous.
We're going to take a listen to a scene from that. In this scene, a chain gang escapes from prison. They break into a woman's house to hide out, and the local sheriff drops by in his pursuit of them. And Woody Allen's character tells the woman that she can answer the door, but she has to play it straight and tell the sheriff that the chain gang are her cousins visiting from out of town. Here's a clip.
I hear there's been some trouble up at the prison. I'm checking the area for anything suspicious.
These are my cousins. They're visiting me for the holiday.
What holiday?
Did you ever hear of St. Abernathy's Day?
No.
Well, that's what we're here for.
Wait a minute. Did I see something move out there? Quick, everybody take one window and check it. If there's somebody out there, we're going to have a chance to see them.
They're escaped convicts.
Really?
They've broken in. Didn't you notice how they all moved together closely? They're chained together at the ankles.
I thought they were just a close family.
Family is sort of chained together at the ankles. It's just a metaphor.
It is a metaphor. Now, what's great about that is you can't see it because we're on radio, but it is literally a group of about five or six guys, some white, some black. And it's a reference to Stanley Kramer's The Defiant Ones, which starred Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis from 1958, about two escaped convicts who are literally shackled together, one being a white racist and the other being a black man. And it's a story about how they're going through the woods and escaping and how they learn how they must cooperate with each other if they're going to try and make it to safety. And, of course, it was directed by Stanley Kramer. And that's all about the social part of what's going on with these prisons. They use it as a metaphor.
Do they make it to safety?
I'm not going to spoil it for you.
Come on.
It's really well worth seeing.
It is okay.
Are there any movies where the criminal in the prison is actually a bad guy? You know, that I know that it's always the likable character in Kenya, but most of the prison movies have these lead characters in prison who have their redeeming qualities outweigh their bad qualities.
Yeah, there are a lot. And I think one film that is actually being remade into an American film is a film called The Prophet, a French film. And it's what I like about this film more than anything else, because it encompasses what you're talking about. It's a story about a young Algerian boy who is an innocent, who's sent to a prison on Corsica, which is controlled by the French Corsican mafia on one side and the Algerian gangs on the other side. And he has to navigate for both of them, and eventually he becomes as corrupt as the system and gains power. So that's a really interesting take, where you take the innocent who gets corrupted by the prison. The other one would be, I'm just thinking of a film that where somebody is bad, but the prison has made them stronger, would be Escape from Alcatraz, mm-hmm. the Clint Eastwood film directed by Don Siegel, where he is in there for a crime. He's not necessarily a good guy. But they create the tension in the film to be able to, like, present him in a better light as he plans an escape from Alcatraz.
This is a clip from that film. In this, Clint Eastwood is eating lunch and telling his fellow cellmates how he's going to plot his escape.
The cell block's really getting old. The moist air is corroding the concrete. And the salt is rusting the metal. And I took a nail clipper. I was digging around the grill back in the cell. I think with some work I could dig that grill out of there, enlarge the hole, and get into the utility corridor, which leads to the top of the cell block, and maybe out on the roof. We'll leave at night. That way you won't know till the morning. We're gonna have to make some dummy heads, make them out of plaster or cardboard or whatever. Put them in the bunks, and the guards won't know.
The oldest trick in the world, putting the dummies in the beds.
Well, there was that great story about the guy that did escape from Alcatraz, even though it was on this island out in the middle of, off California, San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I think he escaped during the time that Whitey Bulger may have been there. And
The escape from Alcatraz is his story.
It's his story.
Yeah. Dramatized and Hollywoodized. Yeah.
Okay, because they never found him, right?
They never found him, and they could never prove whether he'd lived or died.
Right. He might have been swept up in the ocean, mm-hmm. or he might have actually actually escaped from there. But Whitey Bulger was in prison there.
The message is, I know that this Midnight Express, which was a movie that wasn't about American prison, but someone who was a drug mule or
it was a naive American in Turkey trying to smuggle out a bunch of stuff.
That kept me from becoming a drug mule,
I didn't want to wind up in a Turkish prison.
Yeah.
You know what I want to Garen Daly? What do you think of this Orange is the New Black? Because it's not a movie. It's a Netflix kind of experience.
Right.
But it's getting a lot. Of course, it's about this little blonde Martha Stewart type that winds up in prison, the girl. And it's
I watched it in 3 days, the entire series in 3 days.
Binge viewing.
I did.
What do you think of that? It's not on the big screen.
First of all, I think what is going on cable TV is very, very interesting right now. You're getting some really long form stories being told by really well written people who are willing to take chances versus a lot of what Hollywood is doing, which is let's try and find another franchise, tentpole comic book, get the fanboys to come to it and make lots of money and walk away.
And I have to tell you that the binge viewing of good series that I've been doing has really heightened my appreciation for filmmaking in the 2 hour world, because now when you've got this long form of being able to do these story arcs and character development, and now when I go to watch a movie, I'm really appreciative of this compact, if you will, storytelling. I mean, it really has divided the arts a little bit more for me. So,
but it's just such a totally different experience when you see it on the small little computer or you see it on your television.
You
set.
Need a bigger TV.
You do need a bigger TV. Garen Daly, how's the Orson Welles project going?
It's going well, although I'm probably going to have to readjust my timeline. But we are going to be doing a couple of things. We're going to be doing a open-air screening on the 21st of September in Harvard Square on Palmer Street, where we're going to do Bugs Bunny Superstar, which is directed by Larry Jackson, who was a member of the Orson Welles. And then we're in the 31st of October, we're going to be doing a live radio show of on stage. We haven't got it, of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, which will be its 75th anniversary.
That is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. So what's your favorite of these prison movies you talked about today?
I actually like The Prophet. That's why I mentioned it. It's really something to look forward to.
Well, check that out. We have been speaking with film critic Garen Daly, who is also the producer. That's why we're talking about Orson Welles, the producer and director of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. Sue O'Connell, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
With me today. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and South End News has been filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Sue's going to be with me again tomorrow. Charlie Baker is also going to be with us here tomorrow. Maybe he'll tell us if he's actually going to run for governor or not. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Hear us tomorrow, noon to 2. I am Marjorie Egan. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH Radio.